Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowder, and with me, my co-host from the Black Hills of South Dakota, Cowboy Barry Rose. Barry, are you wondering why I'm saying the Black Hills of South Dakota?
I kind of am wondering.
Well, I'm going to tell you, it's a very valid question, because today is the date that we are recording this. I have read, Barry, some very exciting news. I believe I may have texted it to you. Deadwood the movie is being written, and they have brought the cast back, the ones that are still out there. And I am super stoked about Deadwood the movie, because that is one of my all-time favorite TV shows. And that's not just the kind of stuff we talk about here on Breaking Kayfabe. We also talk about sports, movies, television, wrestling. We break kayfabe on life. We break kayfabe on fucking weddings like we did last week, Barry. Today, however, we are going to do a deep dive on the big CWF Legends Fan Fest in Florida. And we had an awesome weekend, got to meet some old friends, some new friends, tremendous time, Barry. We're going to talk about that. We are going to go back to 1972. We're going to talk about a match that has been recently discussed on the 605, the old mothership, a match that was under the banner of All South Wrestling and promoter Ann Gunkel. We're going to, of course, do our favorite Florida man stories for this week. Going to look at an old Tommy Rich video from Georgia Championship Wrestling. Holy crap, Barry. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. Are you about ready to go?
I am. So this is going to be one of these epic six-hour episodes that all of us love so much. So, hey, just to touch on the whole Deadwood movie that's going to be taking place, which I'm real excited about too, but you were a huge fan of that. And I remember going back four, five, six, I forget how many years it's been off the air, but I remember that was a show that you were really, really passionate about. So I'm excited. But what about the other news that you texted me today about, which I had seen and I was ecstatic? They're going to make a Breaking Bad movie? Oh, my God.
That is reportedly the story, and that is also some huge news. That is still more, I think, in the very early stages. The Deadwood movie is actually in the process of being written. I think they're kind of just talking about the Breaking, but obviously, I'm super stoked for that, too. I mean, both of us, big fans of that show. And you know, they obviously stole the name Breaking Bad from our podcast, Barry. I think that's pretty obvious. So
that's true.
Let's talk a little about the good times we had over the weekend. We are recording this on a Thursday evening, fresh off the CWF Legends Fan Fest 4. Barry, give us your thoughts on how the weekend went overall. We had some pretty, pretty notable things that happened at the old CWF Fan Fest.
Oh, boy, did we ever. So this is going to encompass at least a solid hour of us just talking about everything that went down. And I guess I'm going to go back to Friday. We'll do it in chronological order, which seems to make the most sense. But going back to Friday night, and I will say overall, just a general overall view, this was probably my favorite Fan Fest. And I think the reason being, one was, this ran on autopilot. There was really no big issues that required my attention. I was actually concerned prior to the event, because my partner, David Penzer, his wife, Lisa, and she's actually fantastic. As much as I give David a hard time on this show, his wife, Lisa, is fantastic. And she usually watches the front door for us at every event that we do. And she checks people in. She sells tickets and just takes care of the front for us. Well, she couldn't make it this time. So it really came down to David and myself. But the truth was, this thing was on autopilot. It ran super smooth. And I got to, as I always say, I'm the biggest mark in the building. You know, it's a self-serving reason I put on these fan fests. I do it for me, Jeff. I do it, and it's not a financial thing by any stretch. It's because I am the big fan of this.
So you're not making a financial windfall. Is that what you're saying?
I am, and I think it's, you know, it's a fair point. I'm barely breaking even, and I do make a little something, obviously, but I'm barely breaking even by the time I get a plane ticket, I pay for my hotel, my rent a car, you know, once it's all done. And Penzer doesn't have these luxuries, or does, because he drives. He lives 10 minutes away from where the venue takes place. So you can remove all of those charges. So for me, no, I'm not making a lot. At the same time, you know, is there anything at this stage of my life where I can go for 4 days and have essentially that much fun? And I don't think that there is. And, you know, when it was over, and it's funny because Bobby Van Cavalar, a good friend of yours and of mine and somebody we've talked about on the show previously, he and I are in touch. And, you know, it was like Sunday, I saw him and he leaves and it's probably around noon or something like that. And by 3 o'clock, he's texting me and he's going, dude, I'm so bummed all this is over. And I feel the same way. It's almost this postpartum depression that sets in after the event because you've just had a great time. And, you know, Friday night, and we'll definitely get deep into this, you know, we stayed up until 12:30, which for me is actually fantastic. And we sat with Pat Patterson in the lobby, who told the stories for 3 hours. And Saturday night, I sat in the lobby and I was with Bobby and with Travis Raines. And I think Aaron was there, and we just sat around just bullshitting. And, you know, it's just these events, you know, the wrestling aspect is great. It really is, because it's not your typical fan fest, which we always say. The idea is go talk to these guys. They want to talk to you. It's not just about an autograph or a photo, which really, there's not a lot of autographs taking place, except for me, I think, because God knows I'm throwing 50 items in front of a lot of these guys, but everybody's taking photos. But it's the fact that Leilani Kai, which I thought was great, she bounced around every table. You know, she was talking to Jerry Briscoe for 15 minutes and Pat Patterson, and then talked to Bugsy, and everybody talks to everybody and they just go around and it's almost like a family reunion. So this was my favorite. I think partly I had the least amount of stress that I've had with any of the prior events. So that right there is a win-win for me. And the guests were great. You know, the Fuller brothers, who kicked off the morning with doing the coffee talk with Ron and Robert, which went on for an hour and literally could have gone another hour and still would have been super captivating and entertaining. And it was really cool. And I thought of you when I was describing this to someone today, and I was describing this to a guy who runs shows named Nick Massey. And he runs shows up on the East Coast, up in New Jersey. And he was at Rhode Island Comic-Con this past weekend, and the weekend coming up, he's running a show, the big event. He's going to have a vendor's table, and one of the guests is going to be Robert Fuller. So we were talking about the Fuller brothers, and I said, you know, Robert's just he was really just a great guy, and just he's like the life of the party, just a lot of fun. And I said, really interesting, and this is where I referenced you, was Ron and Robert are really completely different personalities, you know, when they do these types of events. And it was kind of like the analogy that you made for Kevin and JJ about how, like, it's Dory and Terry. And you've got Ron, who's a little more serious, but a deep historian when it comes to professional wrestling. And then you've got Robert, who's like loose and carefree, talking more about getting drunk in cars and road stories. So they, as a team, they were fantastic. They could have gone literally another hour, but I could have listened to them for several hours. So that's something I would want to revisit in the future, because I thought they were just amazing together. And Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe, you know, it really two very emotional moments for me with these fan fests. And there's always at least one moment that I always get a little touched by, but you know, and I'm definitely not going in chronological order at this point, Jeff. So I got to say, I had the best intentions.
The hell is the matter with you?
Yeah, exactly right. But Jerry Briscoe, we had Gennard Soli, who is the son of Gordon Soli, and we had Gennard present Jerry with three awards for the CWF Hall of Fame. And I should say, the CWF Hall of Fame, at the end of the day, is no brick and mortar building. It lives on the internet. It lives in the CWF group. It lives in our heads. And it's something that we've asked fans to vote for. And that's pretty much the extent of it. And granted, you know, when I say we asked fans to vote for it, we're asking historians to vote for it. You know, we're asking guys like Scott Teal and Bobby Van Cavalar. So we're asking people who also understand championship wrestling from Florida and really understand the history of it. But to that end, it is something that is self-created. I came up with it 5 years ago. I mean, you know, so we gave Jerry the award, and he got an award for himself, his brother, and then collectively as a tag team. And Jerry was so moved by it that he began to cry as he was accepting the award. He got choked up, and then he had tears. And at that point, I think we were all looking at each other, and we all were getting a little misty-eyed. And Jerry had a great explanation about the whole thing. And he said, you know, as a performer, the greatest recognition as somebody who performed for so many years are the people that paid to see me perform. And to be recognized is the highest honor. And, you know, again, I look at it and I say, you know, we're, you know, these are just fans, you know, in my case, in my basement, voting for the Hall of Fame. But to somebody like Jerry, it was recognition of a 40-year career of people that were paying money. And it's, I guess it's similar to an actor who wins an award, you know, in some form. So he got very emotional, and we got a little emotional, and, you know, just watching how much it meant to him. But Jerry Briscoe, you know, if there's one wrestler that I guess I know I've had the most interaction with over the last 10 years, it might be Jerry Briscoe. And he really surprised me that day, because his storytelling, and he's a great storyteller, but, you know, having spent time with Pat as we did, I thought, wow, Pat's going to filibuster through this entire deal, you know, and he didn't. Jerry was like shot out of a cannon and just telling story after story, and very heartfelt. You know, that was the other part, was, you know, Jerry just, you know, there's a heart there bursting with love for people in that room.
And Barry, we should also mention the travel schedule that Jerry was forced to go through to get back to the Fan Fest, and how he went completely out of his way, basically. Why don't you tell the folks about that?
Yeah, and that was a bit of a concern, and I think Penzer was much more concerned than I was, and I think he was trying to make sure that I didn't freak out. But so Jerry is still an employee of the WWE, and he scouts new talent. So he doesn't go to all the house shows or the TV tapings, but he does do certain things for them. And one of those things is he goes to colleges, whether it's wrestling meets or football games, but he goes to scout collegiate athletes. And he gets his schedule, I guess, the first of every month, but it's a Monday through Friday schedule. So as it goes, he booked a Fan Fest, which is a Saturday appearance, and then found out on a Tuesday he would be going to Denver, but would have to stay Friday night because he was going to, it was a football game or a wrestling match, I'm not quite sure what it was, and he would have to fly out Saturday morning from Denver in order to get to Tampa. So he had to wake up, I think, at 3 a.m. and then get to the airport, and I believe had a 6 a.m. flight in order to be able to make it. So when he came, he was a few minutes late, but he came rushing through the front door. And I don't know if you even know this, he parked his car, his truck, by the front door. I met him outside, and I actually went and parked his truck for him so he could get inside. To compound this, he hadn't eaten. He hadn't eaten since he had had something on the plane, some sort of breakfast. So immediately I went to Tony. Now, if you've stayed at the hotel, you know who Tony is. Tony is the African-American. He is a huge wrestling fan, and he kind of just takes care of us when it comes to food. He does the breakfast in the hotel and was also with us because we do the dinner and the catering. So Tony went and whipped him up, and I don't know if you saw the sandwich, Jeff, but it was this gigantic BLT sandwich. Was like one of the most beautiful sandwiches I have ever seen. And Tony whipped it up and we were able to give it to Jerry. So that was just a real, you know, a true moment for us right there, having all those guys. But I got to say, so now backtracking a little bit, Friday night was great. And we got to meet Pat in the lobby, and it was probably around 5 o'clock, give or take. And we sat in the lobby for an hour and a half with Pat. And it was really our first introduction to Pat at this point. And it was almost like, I mean, there is zero filter there. And he, within 5 minutes of him talking to us, we're hearing stories about his life. And he's, again, there's no filter. And I believe he set the F word, the record for saying the word fuck or motherfucker, more than anybody or any movie or anything I have ever heard or seen, because he literally would, it was like every third or fourth word.
He weaves a tapestry of profanities.
He does, which is great because it goes with the stories. Yeah, it goes with the stories. but his level of using profanities was like, holy cow. We became kind of immune to it within 5 minutes or so. But I remember looking over at you and saying, yeah, tomorrow night's dinner, Jeff, it's going to be gold. And I remember you saying, yeah, we got something here. So that was great. We went off to Portillo's. And how much fun is Portillo's, Jeff?
Yeah, I had the combo, the Italian beef sausage combo, which was, now thinking back, I think I should go with either or as opposed to the combo. I didn't enjoy the combo as much as I would have if I had got one or the other. But, oh, my God, the food is amazing. They had a great milkshake there, too. You know, I think, was it you that had two milkshakes or somebody else? But
had two milkshakes.
Yeah, it's just sick.
I got the chocolate cake shake, which is my favorite milkshake I think I've ever had in my life, where they make you a chocolate shake and they put chocolate cake into it. And that was great. And I wasn't even hungry. I'd had a huge lunch, but I still ate like a pig. But I think we had probably 30 people there, maybe. We had a pretty large group. We had everybody from the Fan Fest. Not everybody, but a core group of fans from the Fan Fest. We had the indie tag team. We had Michael Patrick from the Dirty Blondes. We had Sean Pascal, who was half of the Heartbreak Express. We had Frankie Reyes, a referee for many years, WCW, CWF. His son Adam was there, and then we had all of our regulars. Pete Lederberg was there, and Harold. Mark Beaudry came down from Boston, which I thought was, the guy flew from Boston for this Fan Fest, and in talking with him, he had been involved with professional wrestling. I think he had promoted some shows, possibly with Killer Kowalski, if I'm remembering correctly. So the dinner was great.
Let me just give a quick shout. Mark's a very nice guy. Big minor league baseball fan like myself. Had a very nice conversation on Saturday about Major League Baseball with Mark. So shout out to Mark. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry, Barry.
Yeah, absolutely. Too. I didn't know that either. But just a real nice guy. And I drove him. He and Scott Teal were both in my car. So we left Portillo's. We were there for a couple hours. And that, to me, is just so much fun, too, that we get to all go, and it's a place. You don't have to make a reservation, obviously, which is great. It's affordable, and it's a relaxed atmosphere. And we just have this whole section, and we just, to me, shit like that at this stage of my life it's priceless, legitimately. Something that I think if this was 30 years ago, I would have said, that's great, and life goes on. But, I look back at this and I just go, man, that's just a truly special thing. So then we get back to the hotel, and Pat is sitting in the lobby, and we proceeded to sit with Pat for, I'll say, 2.5 hours, maybe close to 3 hours. And that was an eye opener. So we're obviously going to have a great story here that we're going to tell in a second. And before I get into that, so Pat tells a story, and I'm going to repeat this story, because in the context of what I'm going to tell you, in relaying this, it's very important. But so Pat's telling a story, and he told it 2 or 3 times throughout the Fan Fest. He definitely told it during the dinner, and he's talking about, I think you asked him, I said, so how was Ray Stevens? Which, that's an obvious question. These two are linked. Those careers are linked. And he's like, oh, fucking Ray Stevens. Fuck, motherfucker. He's fucking the best. And,
that wasn't the quote I remembered.
No. Well, this is what's coming. Okay. Right. So he starts to tell this story about Ray Stevens. And this is, I guess, after Pat had turned. And Ray Stevens has got Pat Patterson and, I guess, a chin lock or a headlock. And a big guy stands up and he yells, Stevens, you faggot. Now, granted, I'm quoting Pat here. So this is not my vernacular. And, Pat then whispers to Ray and he goes, Ray, if they only knew. And the referee's gay, too. It was something to that effect. But when he said the word faggot, he screamed the word faggot. So I should say, on the other side of where we're sitting, there's about 20 people, and it's a family. I think there was like a lacrosse or a rugby tournament, and there's young kids, 12, 13, 14, 15, and their parents. And then the area that we're sitting in is, you can directly see the lady at the front desk, mid-30s, short in stature, and a look of complete horror on her face as the word faggot is being screamed at. So that happened, and then obviously every other word was fucker, motherfucker. So the next day, I go up to the lady. She's worked, very, very nice lady. They know us at the hotel at this point as well. And I go up to the lady, and I said, hey, I just want to apologize because, I realized last night that there was some language that was being used over there. And I, he's a 78-year-old ex-wrestler who's still involved in wrestling. There's no way I'm going to tell him he can't speak like that, obviously. And she goes, oh, I don't give a fuck. So I was, and she was obviously, she was pulling a rib on me by saying that, but I just thought that was just the greatest response she could ever have. And then she said, my only concern was the families on the other side, but nobody complained, so I fully get it and I fully understand. But well, Jeff, how amazing was, and this is something, this was not a planned event for the Fan Fest. This was just sitting in a lobby with Pat for 2.5 hours getting an education. I mean, we were, I walked away with a Rolodex of stories after that Friday night.
No, and you're absolutely right about that, or as you like to say, you're 100% right about that.
You're 100% right about
exactly.
That.
Exactly. What I thought you were going to on the Ray Stevens story was when I was sitting next to him and I said, so Ray Stevens, what do you got to tell us about Ray Stevens? And he looks at me and he goes, Ray Stevens, more fucking pussy than any man that was ever in the business. Apparently, yeah. Ray was quite the poon hound. And so Pat had a lot of respect for Ray based on how much pussy he got over the years. But no, it was.
And so do I, Jeff. So do
I. Exactly. I'm glad you clarified that. But it was just Pat, you and I, and about 6 or 7 other guys just sitting around and being enthralled, just sitting at the feet of a legend as he talked. And this was not a, oh, let me tell you about why the WWE is great. I mean, he mixed in stories about Vince and the WWE, but he talked about working for Vern. He talked about his time and working for Roy Scheider and what he thought of Roy Scheider. He talked about working in Florida as Ivan Koloff's tag team partner and his thoughts on Eddie Graham. We asked him to compare Eddie and Roy Scheider, which I thought was very interesting. And, just a great storyteller. And the fact that he was so willing to open up, a vein and, like you said, this was not part of the Fan Fest. It was a guy just sitting around talking shit with a bunch of guys. And he was, so willing. And, along those lines, not that I want to jump ahead, but one thing that I think everyone at the Fan Fest appreciated was at the end of the evening. And we'll get to all the things that happened that we haven't discussed yet. But, Pat said, I consider all of you out there my family because you had so much love for what myself and all the other guys that came here today did that you've come to listen to us. And that just, it's like your brothers to me that all of you that came here and then you could see that it meant a lot to them. And, again, Pat Patterson, this is not a guy that's at a Fan Fest every weekend. And we know guys that are at Fan Fest every weekend, Pat yep. Patterson. This was an extremely rare appearance by Pat Patterson, Barry.
Yeah. And well, and again, I don't think it's lost on you and I, and I don't think it's really lost on anybody that was there, is that we'll never get that experience with Pat ever again. It's not, you're right. There are some guys that are at every Fan Fest, and more power to them. They're making a living by going and taking photos and signing autographs. But this, I don't ever envision another scenario, Jeff, where we're sitting in a lobby with Pat Patterson, and he's just opening up, not just about his career, but his life. And being very honest and very open and very transparent in everything that he's saying. And you're right. At the end of the Fan Fest, as the night wound down after he had sang My Way, which is his closer for karaoke, which we can get into in a little bit, he said, he goes, there's a lot of love in this room, and I consider you family. And Jerry Briscoe had said that as well. And it's true. The Fan Fest, it's not a large group. There was maybe, 115 people in and out these doors. And the core group that stays for the dinner and the awards banquet is 50. I mean, we cap it at 50. So, you know, it's not like they're in front of 20,000 people or for, you know, in, I talked again, my friend Nick, there was like 9,000 people at this Rhode Island Comic Con, which is completely nuts. We're looking at 110, 115 people. So it's a very small core group there. And at the same time, it makes it individualized, and it's an individual experience because every time Jerry talks, he's talking to you. I mean, he's literally, you know, he's looking at everybody. He's making this eye contact. And you really realize, but I don't want to get too far ahead because something occurred on Friday night after, I'll say it was about 11, maybe 11:15, Jeff. And you and I were sitting right next to each other as this happened. And, I got to admit, 4 or 5, what are we at? I guess 6 days later at this point. We're still talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. So just a quick overview here. So if you will, we're sitting basically in a circle in the lobby of the hotel. Pat is to my right. Barry is to my left. And then we have the other gentlemen that are joining us, just listening to Pat tell the stories. And we see through the front door, and of course, the front desk is right across from where we're sitting. We see two young ladies come in. Who are dressed, I don't want to say completely inappropriate, but they look like maybe they worked at a bar or a restaurant. And they had a gentleman with them. And so as they came walking in, Barry leans in and goes, oh, this has got to be something going on here. And they go over and they're very engaging to the front desk clerk. And one of the young ladies turns around and is being very overtly trying to make eye contact with somebody, anybody, to the point where I turned back to Barry and I said, I think we may have a couple professional women here looking to pick up some company for the evening. And because she was just so ridiculously over the top. And so then a friend of the show, Aaron Grafton, got up to, get a beer or a bottle of water or something like that at the little refrigerator next to the front desk. And so as he walked up there, the young lady says, oh, you're going to buy me something? You're going to buy me something? And Aaron, Mr. Smooth, says, no. And so turned around, which is, you know, Aaron's always making a play for the ladies. But so these ladies continue. They're talking. And apparently what they were doing, we found out later, was they were attempting to find out the either the room number or a contact number for somebody that was, dare I say, part of the fan fest. And Barry, why don't you take it from there? We'll kind of split telling this story here because it's a great one.
It is a great one. So, and everything Jeff said was, as I like to say, 100% correct. But so these two women walk in, and they're fairly attractive. Not in the, you know, they're fairly attractive, especially the blonde one who was very overt in all of her gestures, in everything that she was trying to do, and she was trying to make eye contact. And as Bobby Van Cavalar said, she's glaring at every single person. So they walked in, and when they walked in, the blonde said to the brunette something, and I couldn't make out what it was, and the brunette said, oh, I'm already aware, and they both turned around and stared at our group. So we knew that something was up at that point, that something was going on. So they're talking to the guy at the front desk, and we're trying to overhear, but we don't. But we it's, you know, it's so clear with how exaggerated the blonde was and everything she was saying, and she was doing this whole flirty, but it was, you know, it was kind of like, it's like when the stripper pretends she really gives a shit about you. That's what I got from it, you know.
How about your better knowledge on that, Barry, but go ahead.
Howard Baum, I'm paging you, sir. Yes. Howard Baum, I'm paging you.
Mr. Baum.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, at this stage of our lives, we can tell when we're being worked. I mean, you know, we're not 24 just anymore.
You mean they weren't completely interested in us? Is that what you're trying to tell me? I'm crushed.
I was going to say we're in our mid-50s and we're absolutely gorgeous right now. So it's she did go. So Aaron went to get, I think Aaron was going to get beer for everybody. They have beer in the hotel, and she blocks Aaron. And does this suggestive lean. She puts one leg up in a sense and leans she's attractive, and she's like, you're buying me a drink? And God bless Aaron Grafton, he said, no. Just like, you know, even I might have said, yeah, sure, we could talk about that. I might have been reeled in. Aaron was fucking laid it out afterwards and just said, no, absolutely not. And I asked Aaron, and he said, because if I had bought her a drink, my wife would have known and would have called the hotel immediately. I thought that was I thought that was really funny. So,
yes, Mrs. Grafton, Aaron was a good boy, I'm happy to report.
Oh, he was, yeah. The truth, I mean, I don't think anybody there wasn't a good boy at the end of the day. That's, you know, again, this is not...
There was one bad boy that we'll be discussing a little bit in a bit.
Yeah, we will, but that's also different. But, yeah, this is unlike the days, and you and I have said this, and we joke, you know, the big night for us now is going to Portillo's, and if this had been 35 years ago when we, or 25 years ago, 30 years ago when we used to go to the pay-per-views, strip clubs were on the docket. You know, that doesn't happen with us anymore for whatever, whether we have common sense or we're just old. It's one of the two. But so the girls are overly flirtatious. They're staring at us. They're trying to make eye contact. And eventually the blonde, who is, in my opinion, probably the more attractive of the two and possibly the dumber of the two, comes over to Pat Patterson.
A good combo.
Yeah, it's a great combo. And she says to Pat, she's flirting with Pat, which is great, first off, knowing what we know. And she says, is your friend Mr. Herbert? And that's referencing Bertrand Hebert. So Bertrand was with Pat. He is the co-author of his autobiography, which is a fantastic book, by the way. And apparently, as the story goes, Bertrand and Pat, and I'm going to try to make this quick too, Bertrand and Pat had gone over to this restaurant, which is more of a bar. It's a beer garden, essentially. And they had gone over there, and they had been treated rudely by the waitresses. And what was interesting was, I guess Bertrand wanted a beer and he wanted to pay for it. And the girl was demanding that he give a credit card to start a tab. And he's like, well, I don't want to start a tab. I just want a beer and I'll pay cash for it. And she was demanding a credit card for a tab. So he goes, well, wait a minute. I just want a beer and I just want to pay cash. And I guess this went on for a few minutes. And he finally said, this is the weirdest thing ever. And I'm leaving. And he felt it was rude, which it is, and it's not the proper business practices. And he and Pat got up and they went to another bar in the Hilton right next to our hotel, and they had a great experience. So the girl then goes, we're looking for Mr. Hebert, Mr. Herbert, as she said, because he left his credit card in our restaurant and we would like to give it to him, but he's going to have to come over to the restaurant personally after 3 a.m. to pick up the card.
Yeah, nothing sending up a red flag.
Again, somebody that worked in restaurants a little bit, Jeff, that's normal restaurant procedure. Sure,
it
is.
Of course, yeah.
So you and I are looking at each other going, okay, this is like, you know, the thing is, these girls were, especially the blonde, she was a fucking moron. Because if you're going to try to pull a con, you are the worst scam con artist I have ever seen in my life, you know, which encompasses a lot of ground. You know, it really says a lot about how pathetic your scamming was. So the girls, and we should say they had a guy with them, and this guy, he was a fairly beefy dude, you know. Wasn't the tallest guy ever. He was maybe 6 foot, but he was a 6 foot, 200 pounds at least, maybe a little bit more. So he could have done some damage. So after they said that they were looking for Bertrand because he had left his credit card, and if he wants it, he has to come over personally and talk to the manager after 3 a.m. to get it, we felt something was up. To Pat's credit, he didn't give up any information. Pat did take a photo with these ladies. We did put it in the group, but after telling the story, we will post this again in the group. So I got upstairs that night and I messaged Bertrand and I said, hey, Bertrand, something really strange happened. And I explained, and he came back to me and he said, well, that's fucking interesting, man, because I didn't leave a credit card there. I never took my credit card out. There's no credit card to give me back. So in finding out as the story went, Bertrand went up to his room and he wrote a really negative review on their Facebook page. To that end, the two girls and the guy show up looking for Bertrand underneath the guise that they want to return his credit card, which they don't have because he never used one. So what did they want Bertrand to do? They wanted Bertrand to go over there at 3 a.m. so they could talk to him and give him free beer? No, something was up. Something was really shady. So we knew immediately that, okay, you know, again, this was pretty fucked up right here. We could tell this was fucked up. Well, Jeff, the story continues.
And so by the way, before you continue, think about this, folks. We had a couple of young girls come and try to work Pat Patterson, who's been in the wrestling business for 50 fucking years. And then, of course, they tried to weave their spell on Pat, who, dare I say, with his lifestyle, immune to their charms, I'm thinking. But watching Pat try to counterwork the girls by going, what was the name? Mr. Herbert? I don't remember that name at all. And just it was hilarious watching Pat fucking work the girls back with his masterful way. And of course, these two girls being so oblivious and idiotic didn't realize they were getting worked. And it was pretty fucking hilarious.
I'm so happy you just added that, because you're 100% correct, as I like to say, Jeff. Pat was like, I don't know, who are we talking about? What's his name? Now, he had spent the past 2 weeks with this man on a daily basis. He's literally spent the last 3 years with him in doing the autobiography, and every personal appearance that Pat makes, Bertrand is with him. He's kind of his unofficial agent at this point. So, yeah, that was really incredible. And this one, the blonde, was so dense. That's what made it, you know, that's what I couldn't figure out. Though she would go, okay, it's nice to meet you, sir. We're looking for Mr. Herbert. And she's talking really slow, like he's senile or something. And it was just, we're just sitting there going, you just got to be kidding me. You just got to be kidding me. And I was like, inside, I'm getting a little pissed off and I'm ready to start, you know, but I'm like, just shut up and just enjoy this show. So as the story continues, Jeff, as we find out, we get a message from our boy, Travis Rains. Travis, who came all the way from North Carolina. And I tell you, I actually got to spend a lot of time with Travis this time, and we had a lot of fun. So, yeah, I was really happy he could make it. But he goes, hey, I don't know if you guys are aware, but the feud continues. So Bertrand had written this negative Facebook review, which was very honest, you know, and the business replied. And then they went back and forth. And what we'll do is I'll take snippets of all of this, screenshots, so we can put this in the group when this episode drops in a couple of days. And they're going back and forth.
Hey, Barry, yeah. I got a great idea.
Sure.
While we're sitting here, why don't we pull up Bertrand's message, and I will play the part of the restaurant and you play the part of Bertrand. How about that?
All right, hold on 1 second. Do you
we are just
what a genius idea right here.
Free flowing here, folks. That's what you get here on Breaking Kayfabe.
Yeah, it's going to take me just a second to get myself all ready, but it shouldn't take too long. And I got to say, it is, again, you know, I was in the restaurant business. I realize how things are done and how things shouldn't be done. And I truly have to question why the restaurant would look to engage anybody this way. And there were some accusations made, which I found was interesting. But what I'm really interested about, and I'm sure I'm not going to take this any farther, though I did think about it, is are the owners of this restaurant aware of what's taking place? Because if you read the other reviews, this is not the first time this kind of stuff has ever happened in this restaurant. And that makes it interesting to me, because I do believe, and we used to have restaurants like this in New York City, there are certain places where people will go in and the manager works with the servers to rip off the guests. And I believe in reading other reviews that this might be taking place in this restaurant. And odds are the owners have no idea. This is kind of happening. And I think, you know, they've got a manager, whatever. So, okay. So I did pull it up. So I'm sorry, Jeff, who are you? Are you playing Bertrand or are you playing the restaurant?
I'm going to be the restaurant. Okay.
Oh, you're picking the good character here. Because these guys are fucking nuts.
Yeah, I'm gonna be the heel here. So this is
okay.
The breaking kayfabe dinner theater performers. Here we go. Are you ready?
So you know, maybe we should think about this. Maybe at the end of the year, maybe we have what we call the kayfabies, where we give out awards for.
It's a very good name.
Yeah, the kayfabe. Right, that's pretty good.
Okay, here we go.
I am Bertrand Hebert, and Bertrand Hebert doesn't recommend I won't say the name, but I will say doesn't recommend this place that sells beer right near our hotel in Lutz Ford. I'll let you do the work. November 2nd at 7:46 p.m. And he has a French accent, and I'm not going to do that because I don't want to embarrass myself. However, very rude bartender who could not care less about just being nice and take care of her customers, because acting and talking like she wanted me didn't work me is no reason to be disrespectful. Terrible place.
And the restaurant replies, "Dear sir, we are sorry you had a bad experience and felt that our bartenders did not provide good service. After further investigation and reviewing our cameras and speaking to the customer nearby, please keep in mind that in our establishment, we strongly believe in respect and kindness. Just because our bartenders are young and chose to be in the service industry does not mean they deserve to be belittled and treated poorly. Just like everyone else in any and all other industries, a little kindness in words and less snapping of fingers and rude remarks will always get you better results. If we got off on the wrong foot, let's try again. We strongly believe that just because you are a paying customer does not give you the right to treat others with disrespect. Kindly."
Lol, laughing out loud. "I encourage everyone to try your establishment. They will see I am right. Nothing like being ignored by a bartender to get a good review. Clients who were friends of her were obnoxious, if not dangerous, and always nice to see bullies in a bar. Your explanation does not explain people showing up at my hotel looking for me after I posted my review underneath the false pretense of giving back my credit card, never left my wallet, and telling my friends I should come by and pick it up after 3 a.m. I have to scroll down, Jeff, so I apologize, with the manager. The Hilton bar nearby loved us, and they got good tips, and we drank there two nights in a row. No need to drop your credit card at the bar, and it was not even our hotel." He then posted right again, "Proof of that weird follow-through at my hotel by two of your employees after my review," and that's a photo of Pat with the two girls.
"Sir, no one said you left your wallet. Our good friend left his tab open, and the girls went to notify him. You guys were sitting at the bar and asked if you can take a pic. Please don't twist this as if my bartenders followed you to your hotel room. Seriously. Regardless, you're not happy with our place. Sorry you had a bad experience. Wishing you the best at other places. Have a good day." And just for the record, why do you have pictures saved of our bartenders on your cell phone if they're so horrible and followed you to your hotel and they're smiling and posing in this pic? The story doesn't add up. I think it's quite inappropriate. Definitely wishing you the best at other places. Have a good day.
Well, it was the talk of the hotel. That actually is true. And the convention, the weird exchange from your bartender showing up looking for me. People had it on their Facebook, just proving that they showed up at my hotel after the Facebook comment. I felt it was worth it to share to prove the unwanted visit, since none of us had our credit cards out. Literally everyone that was in the lobby that night came to ask me what was going on with your people showing up looking for you. Well, not planning a visit to the Tampa area anytime soon. Still weird to send two employees on the clock to a nearby hotel looking for clients who paid their tabs.
Okay, sure. Our bartenders are obsessed and head over heels for you. Have a good day.
That's not what I said. Sad. I said you send people to intimidate me under false pretenses so I would change what I wrote. Funny that you were the only establishment not full in the area that night. So, and that wraps it up. To that end, if you read the other reviews, A, They're always defensive, which they are with this review, which is the worst thing that you could possibly do. And B, they've used the same line after reviewing our security and our videotapes and speaking with other customers. These guys are so full of shit. So in reading this, I got to be honest, my first impression is the manager is working with the servers in some sort of scam. And I bet the owners of this establishment don't have any idea.
Yeah, it was absolutely fucking crazy. And, you know, here's another part of the story we haven't told, Barry. So, as you mentioned, our friend Bobby Van Kevlar was sitting there with his phone recording our conversation with Pat.
Yeah.
And so as these two girls walk in, they're being videotaped. And at one point, the blonde actually goes, "Oh, you're videotaping us. That's so nice." And starts smiling for Bobby's phone. The other thing is the fact that the manager, in telling the version of the story that I was reading, made it seem as though Bertrand was the one that the two girls had come. "Oh, you wanted to take your picture with us." It wasn't Bertrand. It was Pat that they were taking the photos with. So he completely screwed up his timeline there. And yeah, needless to say this. Now, the great thing is this wasn't even the best story of the weekend, folks. That's the kind of good quality stuff you get at a CWF Legends event. That's why we encourage you to come down for these things, because some kind of shit always hits the fan. And now this is the first story about the shit hitting the fan. So before we get to number two, let's talk more about the day of the Fan Fest, Barry. One of the things I want to mention is how great the little coffee chat was with Robert and Ron Fuller, who were both super, super engaging. Very nice guys. And we actually got him to cut a little video promo for our show, which was pretty funny. But one of the things I really appreciated was the day of the event. Apparently, I believe might have been the day after the anniversary of the death of Brad Armstrong. And because yeah. I'm such a big fan of Brad Armstrong, and I know you are too. And here we had Robert and Ron, two guys that were such instrumental figures in Brad's career. I mean, not like they gave, you know, Brad any sort of break he didn't deserve, but you know, they were there at different moments in Brad's career. And so I asked both of them, I said, "Can you tell me a memory of Brad's career?" And Robert happened to mention that he was there the night that Brad made his wrestling debut in Alabama, which I thought was really interesting. I didn't know that when I asked the question. And they both, I have to tell you, just spoke glowingly of Brad and what a quality individual he was. Dare I say, we're getting ready to talk about someone who's not such a quality individual. And, you know, quite honestly, folks, you know, there are some skeevy people that are around the wrestling industry or in the wrestling industry. And pretty much the universal opinion was that Brad Armstrong, in the minds of Robert and Ron Fuller, was not one of those people. He was a good quality human being who was taken from us far too soon. Ron told us a very funny story about the first night that that Brad got color and apparently got a little too eager. I think we could say, Barry, and Ron in the dressing room had to apply a compression bandage because let's just say there was a faucet coming out of Brad's head. And so he was extremely concerned that this would negatively affect Brad. And he said that he asked Brad how, you know, as he's got the compression bandage up to his head, "How you doing?" And he said Brad just had the biggest smile on his face. And he said he knew that Brad was going to be a great fit for the wrestling business and, you know, the wrestling industry, because he was somebody that here an event had happened where he cut himself a little too deep, that would be the kind of thing that might scare away other people. But Brad was just so into what had happened, was so happy to be part of the wrestling business, Barry.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's the other thing. So there's so many stories that come from, you know, the fact that we give these guys a forum to actually share with us. So the Fuller brothers, honestly, they, you know, when it was over, I spoke with Ron and Robert and I said, you know, this can't be the end of our relationship, because we could do another hour easy. They both had fun doing it. That was the cool thing. Like, they came in and it's a relaxed atmosphere. Robert had his wife and Ron had his girlfriend there. And they were just telling these stories, and these stories just flow. There's no scratching of a head trying to remember. This stuff just flows out. And these guys were so good. There was a story, and I am going to jump around a bit, but so Jerry Briscoe told a story, and you know, I love, you know, there's no secret here to anybody listening to this, but how much I love championship wrestling from Florida. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, that's it for me. And he told a story, and it was great because it answered so many questions for me. So in 1976, which was, I think, my second favorite year for CWF, with 75 being my favorite year, we really saw the ascension and the rise of Bob Orton Jr. And he had been half of a tag team in Georgia with Dick Slater, and he came to Florida, and they aligned him with Carl Von Steiger. And they were, you know, they weren't going to go too far. I think Von Steiger was gone, I don't know, maybe a month after they started teaming, and Orton Jr. turned on Von Steiger, and then he was out. And Orton Jr. was by himself, eventually aligning himself with Roop and his father, Orton Sr. But Jerry's telling a story that when Bob Orton Jr. came back to Florida, that his brother Jack saw so much potential and promise, and he said, "Give me Orton Jr. for a couple of months. I really want to get this kid to the next level." And lo and behold, Bob Orton Jr. was a guy that went from prelims or mid card, and all of a sudden became the top guy and the top heel in the state. And he was, you know, Bob Orton Jr. was 215 pounds, which at that time, if you were a heel, you were more like King Curtis or Abdullah the Butcher. You were a monster. You were a monster that Dusty would face. And instead, they took this clean-cut, all-American kid, pardon me, and made him the biggest heel in the state. And Jack was so impressed with him that Jack actually dropped the Florida title to Bob Orton Jr. in St. Petersburg at Jack's behest. So I always wondered in myself, you know, I always said, that's kind of a big deal that you've got this kid that's only been wrestling for, you know, 3 years, 4 years, and all of a sudden you've made him the Florida champion, and he just beat the former world champion for the Florida title, and he's the top heel in the state. You know, that's really laying it out there and giving this kid the ball to run with. And to find out, it was Jack's idea, and Jack went to Eddie and lobbied for it. And to Jerry's point, what he was saying with the story was, wrestling in life isn't about you. It's about, what can you give back? What can you do to make things better and give back? And that's where he was going with this, and that's why he told that story. But for me, I'm sitting there, and I'm just fucking spellbound, because I always wondered, what was the thought process in taking Orton Jr., who clearly was great, but at the same time was kind of an unproven commodity? How do you take this kid and make him your number one star in the entire state? And Jerry tells this story, and I walk away, and I'm like, wow, this is the greatest fucking thing ever.
Yeah, he was pretty fantastic. So, and by the way, Jerry also had, I should mention, a great story when one of the people at the Fan Fest somewhat sarcastically asked Pat about his famous Intercontinental Championship win in the tournament in Rio de Janeiro. And Pat very, very humorously said, "Oh yeah, it was only about 30 people there. It was bad weather, so not a lot of people remember it." And so Jerry took the mic and said, "Well, let me tell you something. I went to Rio de Janeiro for the Olympics a couple years ago, and I had a cab drive me to the former arena. And there is a details in very elongated fashion, the search for this one officer that was on the force back then who remembered the famous tournament in Rio de Janeiro." And Jerry's just weaving a tale for the folks, and everyone's laughing. And he says, "And I found this plaque on the ground. Here is the site of Pat Patterson's victory in the famous." And it was really a funny story. And Jerry has a great way. He tells a great, both of them are fantastic telling stories. And just
that was such a good story, Jeff. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because Jerry spent 10 minutes telling this story, and he was so serious, had every detail. He'd obviously told this story before, because it was so intricate, and it captivated everybody. And when he was done telling that story, people were like standing up and clapping. That's what I remember. That was a killer story. I hope somebody recorded that.
Yeah. There was a lot of people recording that evening, and maybe we were lucky enough to have someone pick that up. Okay, before we get to the final detail, I will mention, you briefly touched on Pat Patterson doing karaoke. And, you know, I got to tell you something. You really feel honored when you have somebody. And I will say, we had a couple of people, the one person from our group, Aaron Grafton. I'm going to give Aaron a round of applause, because Aaron showed some real stones by going up. And I want to say he did an Elvis song. He went up and did karaoke, and there was only like maybe one or two other people besides Aaron who did it. Pat did about three or four songs, and it was really just a kind of a moment where you sit there and you're like, what am I watching here? And Pat, as you said, put so much emotion into his closing number about, you know, My Way. And, you know, is he Frank Sinatra? No, but he puts every bit the emotion in that song that that Frank Sinatra puts, dare I say, in his version. And he told a very interesting story while we were in the lobby about how Paul Anka was bringing this song to Frank Sinatra and said, hey, I got this song I wrote. It'd be perfect for you. And that Frank Sinatra basically poo-pooed it and said, I don't want anything. This song's not for me. You know, people have moved on from my career. They're into different kind of, you know, of course, the, you know, 60s and in the early 70s. And then he basically demanded that Frank Sinatra sit down, look at this song, and the rest, as they say, is history, because it became such a monster hit from Frank Sinatra. So now, Barry, let's take a look at the other thing that was of note of the CWF Legends weekend. And, you know, much like Alanis Morissette said, sometimes it's the fly in your Chardonnay, and we definitely had a fly in our Chardonnay that night, Barry. You know, much as I said, we had Darwin as sort of the wedding crasher at my daughter's wedding in the last episode. We had a, I won't call the person a gate crasher, but we had an uninvited guest who showed up and decided they were going to be the life of the party. And, you know, as I sit there and I started thinking about how I wanted to address this, I don't want to mention the person by name because I'm not sure, number one, if it's either what the person really wants, which is to have their name out there, or number two, if it's going to be something that's going to completely set the person off. But suffice to say, this person, whether they were overserved or not, suddenly decided they wanted to be the life of the party. Just like the bridesmaid at my daughter's wedding that we spoke about, Barry, we had someone that decided they were going to be the whole fucking show, Barry.
Yeah, and whether this guest, and what do you want to call this guest? Do you want to call him
We want to give no name, don't call him anything.
All right,
we'll just say the guest. The guest.
So it's ambiguous whether the guest was invited or not. He may have been invited by my partner, David Penzer, based off of some quote-unquote supposed advertising that was going to be done that we saw zero results for. So I'm a little unsure. The story's a little fuzzy. But what is not fuzzy was we've done four Fan Fest, this being the fourth one, Jeff. And the first three, we didn't have the Flaherty in the group. Even though Flaherty was at three, was on his best behavior, but we did not have that person that has to get inebriated, that has to draw a serious attention to themselves to the point of really interfering with other people. You know, one of the things that really got me about it, and there were a couple of things that really kind of ticked me off about it. One was, if you're not a paying guest, there is some sort of decorum if you're entering somebody else's realm. That's my opinion. That doesn't make it right or wrong. It's the way that I feel. And this person showed up, and during the Q&A that you were moderating, Jeff, was very loud, was borderline obnoxious. I'm going to have to assume drunk without knowing, but, you know, I just – usually you don't see this kind of behavior, and that got to me. And then to find out that this person was posting negative comments on social media about our two invited guests. And that's where I think, when I found that out and somebody actually showed that to me, that's where I kind of got, you know, I can take the, you're drunk or not, you're an obnoxious asshole. That's a given. I mean, you know, that there's really no question about that. But I really can't take where, you know, you're a non-paying guest at an event, and at the same time, you're criticizing the guests that we have, you know, and it's criticizing them personally. It wasn't criticizing them as far as being our guests, but it was something that they had said. And I just found that just really without any sort of tact whatsoever. That being said, this individual really isn't known for his tact. I guess I was expecting too much. But, you know, every event you talked about, look, you talked about the young lady the week before when we did the wedding episode and how she was obnoxious. And, you know, and she had had a little bit too much to drink and was drawing a lot of attention to herself. The wedding had to be, you know, at least that aspect of the wedding had to be about her. That's similar to what this person was doing. It was, you know, hey, look at me. I'm going to be loud. I'm going to say really beyond outrageous things to try to get a shock out of you. And let me see how obnoxious I can get. And, you know, actually succeeded on all of those levels, Jeff.
You know, as I've sat and thought about this for a couple of days now, you know, one of the things that I was taught by Pete Lederberg when I was in the process of being smartened up, he told me something that always stuck with me. And that is that wrestling is one of those businesses where the closer you get to the flame, the more you get burnt by it. The closer to the fire, the closer to the inner circle of what wrestling really is, you're either completely engaged in it and you want more, or you're completely repelled by it. Wrestling is a business, much like I was trying to think as I was sitting here today watching and catching up on The Deuce, the show on HBO.
I'm going to interrupt you right there because God knows that's what I do. Did you finish the last two episodes?
I am close to finishing the second one, so don't fucking spoil anything.
Okay. Because you know I'm getting ready to say something right now.
Okay. So okay. I'll just say I saw the episode where one of the pimps took a hit. Anyway, this reminded me that wrestling is like politics. It's like pornography. It's like a lot of things. There are some people that you meet that are really good people. We were talking about Brad Armstrong, who by all accounts was a really good person. And you know, there are also people that you meet that are not such good people that, you know, they got a little skeevo to them. And it's, you know, it's like politics. Good Lord knows there's people that are skeevos in politics. There are people that are also really good people in politics. And, you know, all I can say is, I guess maybe we ran into someone that, and we'll just give that person the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it was because they were under the influence of some inebriants and they decided to become the whole show. Maybe without the inebriants, this person's a good person, Barry. I'm just trying to be nice here. Okay.
Yeah, are. You're being really nice about it too. And I'm going to remove that. And I'm going to say, no, you're giving this person the benefit of the doubt. And let's be honest, this was the talk of the fan fest the night that it was occurring. And not in a bad way, is like, oh my God, more like, holy shit, what a show. Like what a spectacle this human being puts on. But this, you know, this person, besides being obnoxious, besides being overbearing, besides being loud, is also extremely braggadocious. And I don't know if we've ever used that word before on the podcast. So that's a fantastic. Yeah, I was going to say that's a real Scrabble word right there. But this person must have referenced about how he can get people into Comic Cons and just everything a million times. And it just was like, oh, dude, just stop already. And you're right. You know, look, there's a lot of the Dirty Blondes are there. These guys are salt of the earth. These guys are respectful. They're old school. They both messaged me after the convention and said they had a great time and thanks for having them there. And Bob Cook messaged me and said, hey, you know, thanks for always letting me come to these things. And that isn't necessary, I should point out, but hey, it's really nice that, you know, it certainly isn't necessary because those three wrestlers I just mentioned were all invited guests. But when you've got somebody that, you know, is just talking, you know, about how this person is an ex. This is Cliff Clavin with no lovability factor whatsoever. This person is an expert on everything. And Jeff, you made a reference to this as you and I were sitting at the dinner table. And I got to admit, I really like this restaurant Glory Days, by the way. I like a lot of the food that comes out of the kitchen. That burger is unbelievable. But this person was talking and giving their political views that were, you know, socialist. And I remember you looking at me and I'll never forget the look on your face. You go, yeah, this is where I'm going to fucking get my political views from. And you were 100% right, Jeff.
As I am on most things. But here's another thing that I've learned from following the wrestling business for, good Lord, 9/10 of my life, I think, Barry.
Yeah.
One of the things I told a friend of mine after I had, dare I said, become smartened up to some extent. Because are we all really smart, Barry, to the business? I don't know if we ever truly become smart to the business. But, you know, I'll give an example. When I, when yourself and myself and some other friends were sitting there talking to Pat Patterson, you know, I didn't sit there and offer my opinions on the business to Pat Patterson. Because you know what? Pat Patterson could give two fucks about what I think about the wrestling business, okay? I was there to sit and keep my mouth shut, occasionally ask a question about something, because Pat Patterson is the guy that knows the fucking business. He's the reason I'm there. It's nobody's there to see me, okay? And guess what? No one was there to see you. And unfortunately, when you're someone who apparently thinks they know it all already, no one can tell you anything. And I think that's the whole result of this particular episode of The Weekend, Barry, is that we had someone who decided to let everyone know that he knows everything, when in fact, maybe he doesn't know quite as much as he maybe thinks he does.
Yeah, and, so, that's, and that's such a great point, too, Jeff. And then we'll wrap this up so we don't have to belabor this. But, you know, there are some people that get drunk and it becomes almost amusing for you. You know, you sit and you watch and you go, geez, look, you know, and you know that they're drunk, but at least they're good hearted. And I certainly didn't get the vibe from this person. This person, again, had to wear their resume, which in my opinion is a doctored resume, because I've seen zero results from any of the bragging about this. There's nothing that's there. And it's just a lot of trying to force feed and shove what I think I am down everybody's throat. And quite frankly, Jeff, I don't think any of us, based off of conversations, any of us were buying any of it. Would you agree?
I think that's a valid point. Let's get back to some fun stuff, a better topic. You know, recently on the Mothership Facebook group, they have been discussing a match that took place on December 1st, 1972 at Atlanta in the Oglethorpe Gymnasium. That's a six-man tag. We are talking The Assassin II, Tom Renesto, the Hollywood Blondes, Buddy Roberts, and Jerry Brown, taking on Argentino Apollo, Tommy Sigler, and Roberto Soto. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match, and we saw some of the comments that, you know, Brian has talked about this on his show because of all the discussion they did on the Georgia area. Tell us what you thought of this match.
Yeah, sure. So I can just go from metal to stew to this match as a seamless transition, Jeff.
Exactly.
We are true professionals, and if nothing else, of course we can do that. So I do have to take a deep breath for a moment as I got all worked up during that last segment. And just to make a minor correction, so this is actually Jody Hamilton. And Tom Renesto was Assassin 1, and Jody Hamilton was... Yeah, it's confusing, and here's the deal.
Corrected. I stand corrected.
Well, but here's it is confusing. So Renesto was one, and Jody Hamilton was two, and Renesto was basically semi-retired to retired at this point, and Jody Hamilton then just became the Assassin. But then when he took on another member, he then became the Assassin one, and everybody else became two and three. So,
well, one of the confusing things that's very interesting about that, Barry, is because there is a reference they make, the announcers,
yes,
to the fact that there used to be an Assassin One who's no longer in the area or no longer part of this company. They make some sort of reference to that. So that's actually ties in very. Thanks. I appreciate you clearing that up for me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
He was booking at the time, actually.
Of course.
Was booking. So this is, and I have seen this match, but I, you know, when we talked, and we should say, this match was actually chosen by Brian Brock of the Dirty Blondes. As we're sitting at the table that night at this place called Glory Days, and it's a sports bar, but I think the food is a step up. Anyways, we're sitting, the three of us are right near each other. It's Brian Brock from the Dirty Blondes. The Dirty Blondes are the hottest indie tag team out there currently. They're on MLW television. I think it's, you know, why they're not in TNA, I don't understand, but I also think that's probably any moment that they're going to wind up in TNA. And I only say that because they live in the Tampa area, you know, and there's just a connection right there. But these
and
guys
very
are
good guys, too. Very good
They both messaged me the next day thanking me for letting them come to the fan fest. But anyways, Brian Brock, as we sat at the table having dinner and some drinks that night, we said, what match would you like to see? Because he listens to the show. What match would you like to see? And I believe you may have brought it up, and he said, oh, I've seen that. It's a great match. What I like about the Dirty Blondes, they go on YouTube, and they study professional wrestling from 30, 40, and 50 years ago. They're not guys who are looking to do high-flying lucha moves. They're looking at teams like the Hollywood Blondes and Dusty Rhodes and Dick Slater. So immediately they've got my admiration and respect. That's a big thing. So long story short, or maybe not so short, we asked Brian. Brian chose this match, and I think that's a great choice. I love this match, Jeff, and I've seen this match when we decided that we're going to talk about it. I'm like, you know what? You could make me watch this every day on an endless loop, and I would watch it. So this is, in my opinion, this is the wrestling you and I grew up with, and it's not. This match could have taken place in Florida, absolutely could have. It is everything I remember professional wrestling as a kid, and it is literally. I want to say it's textbook perfect from what I remember. But as you mentioned, Tommy Siegler, Roberto Soto, Tommy Siegler, I have a connection with, obviously, which you know about. I ran his fan club as a young Mark, as opposed to the old Mark that I am now. As a young Mark, I ran fan clubs for Tommy Siegler, Billy Robinson, and Rocky Johnson. And Tommy was a great guy, a very good wrestler, tremendous human being. Roberto Soto, Jeff, he may or may not have shown up at the first CWF Legends Fan Fest.
Opinions vary.
Everybody's got a different version. And Argentina Apollo, who is a, and I don't think I'd ever seen him wrestle before, but I think he was shorter and smaller than I thought. And he was good. You know, he does a couple of things that I think are pretty good. Wrestling against Jody Hamilton, he looks like he's in tremendous shape here. He's the thinnest
I've ever
seen.
That's part of the reason why I wasn't sure it was Jody. Yeah. The guy's in such great shape.
Like him. Yeah, absolutely. He's, you know, based off the assassin that we saw, he's maybe 30 to 50 pounds lighter, I would say. And then you've got the Hollywood Blondes. I mean, Buddy Roberts, what a career. God bless his soul. Rest in peace, Buddy Jack. You know, you go from a guy, you look at his career, and he did a lot in his career, but he was one half of just a tremendous tag team, and they were together for 5 or 6 years. And then he became Dale Valentine. He was Johnny Valentine's brother when Johnny was booking in Texas. And that connection actually began in Florida. Johnny was the booker in Florida, and Buddy Roberts had left the Hollywood Blondes and was wrestling as a single, but really was just doing prelim and mid-card. When Johnny left, he took Buddy with him. They went out to Texas, and he became Texas heavyweight champion, and also became Dale Valentine, which was really bizarre. And then he hooked up a couple of years after that with the legendary Freebirds. And, I mean, you just talk about a guy, you know, from one half of one of the best tag teams of all time with the Hollywood Blondes to becoming a Freebird, that's a fucking career right there. So this match, you know, and I don't know what I'm going to say. You know, there's no one moment in this match that you go, oh, my God. You know, I can't believe he did this, you know, triple pile driver off the top rope onto the concrete or something like that that takes place in Japan. But at the same time, the entire match and the announcers, they make reference to it. The entire match is it flows. There's no slowdown. There's no, you know, stopping point. This match, which goes a little over 20 minutes, is from start to finish a really good match. And I'll tell you the real surprise of this match for me was Roberto Soto, how good he was. I only remember Roberto from his time in Florida. He never really got a true push. He was, again, prelims and mid-cards. He was really good. He's the Georgia heavyweight champion here, but really good in the ring. And I want to say, you know, I hate to use the word underrated, underappreciated so much better, but just a real solid worker. The Assassin is great. And, you know, one of the things I've said about the Assassin for years was, for a guy his size, he always moved like he was 100 pounds lighter. He had this natural rhythm in the ring. And I remember seeing him in Miami so many times, and he would do the knee drop to the forehead. And everybody talks about Flair's knee drop to the forehead. You would swear the Assassin was going to decapitate somebody when he would do this. So just a solid worker. You know, and Apollo was good. Apollo, in watching this match, he does a couple of things that I think are pretty cool. He's definitely kind of one-dimensional with what he does, but his career was interesting to me. He was actually half of the Florida Tag Team Champions. I believe it was 1970 with Jose Lothario, who just passed away a couple of days ago. And they were tag team champions. And Apollo, when he went up to Georgia, he went to work for Gunkel. And I don't think he ever worked a non-outlaw territory after that. I might be wrong, but he worked for Gunkel. And then I think he went to work for the IWA, which obviously was the Eddie Einhorn IWA, which was a huge outlaw promotion. And I think he was pretty much done at that point. He might have spent time in Puerto Rico, I'm not really sure, but they make reference to the fact that he was a painter in his spare time, and I know that when he retired from wrestling, he became a painter, and it was, I guess, a professional painter, because he was selling his works, and if you look on eBay, I must have looked a year or two ago, there was actually some of his paintings were on eBay. His real name was Vicente de Negres, or something similar. I'm sure I'm completely fucking butchering that name, but he was actually a really good artist. Actually, this wasn't like just a hobby thing. This guy actually had legitimate talent. So I thought that was interesting. The assassin, I think he's one of the greats of all time. I truly do. He's just so good in everything he does from A to Z. The announcers were great. So one of the announcers was Ed Caprell. I don't know who the other announcer was.
Ray McKay.
Who was it?
Ray McKay. They actually mentioned his name later during the match.
And Ray, I believe, is the guy who's got the very professional delivery, Jeff. He sounds like a radio guy almost, but
probably could be a podcaster, if you know what I mean.
So, like, everybody at this point, right? But
his professional voice.
Oh yeah. Well, if he was alive, I got to imagine he's somewhere around 130 at this point. Maybe a little older. I don't know. Cause he didn't sound like a youngster, but, one of the two, I just got such a kick out of this. One of them says, "A lovely lady has just come to us at the microphone, and I hate to have you in that crouching position."
Yeah, that was great.
The lovely Ann Gunkel. So I don't know if that was like one of those Gorilla Monsoon Patterson references with the double entendre, but holy fuck, he said that. And then immediately, within a minute, they go to a shot of Ann Gunkel, and she's got some guy, and she's holding him by his head, and she's whispering into his ear. It was really awkward. You got to see this. When, you know, Jeff always puts up the links to the matches. This is the part of this match when he says about this, about, you know, "I hate to have you in the crouching position." And then you see her a minute later, and she's holding this man by his head with both hands, and she's saying something in his ear. It's an awkward moment, to say the least. But I got to admit, 40-something years later, I actually love it. I will say, Apollo throws a drop kick. And, you know, I got to admit, it wasn't the greatest drop kick. And I think I was expecting a little bit more based off of, he had modeled his gimmick after Argentino Roca. And if you watch, he throws three or four drop kicks. They're all one-legged drop kicks.
And he lands on his feet.
Yeah, it's the old Tony Atlas. If you remember, Tony Atlas used to throw these kind of one-legged drop kicks where he would land on his feet with the other foot. It just, I don't know. I don't connect with it. However, the big surprise at the end is the assassin throws a drop kick, and it looks like a fucking $1 million. Like, even a guy, Jody Hamilton's throwing drop kicks, and it looks fantastic. He can do no wrong. So I got to say, I really enjoyed this match. This may be one of the best looks at the old territory system that I've ever seen. And I know we said that about the Jerry Briscoe, Danny Hodge match. The only fault with that, it wasn't a complete match. You were getting bits and pieces of it. This is a full match from start to finish. The camera work is great. This, the camera work here seems like light years above what I remember seeing in the 70s. It's crystal clear. The lighting is fantastic. The cameramen are doing a great job. I don't think we're missing anything, but if you have any interest in what wrestling was like in the 1970s, I can't think of a better representation than this six-man tag team match.
Yeah, I was sitting there as I was watching this match thinking, Barry, I don't know if there is a older match out there that's the entire match. I know that there's some stuff out there from the AWA from the maybe the early to mid 70s, but I think this is even older than that. And again, as you said, the fact that the video quality is just so pristine, you know, you might as well be watching a match from yesterday, for God's sakes. Couple of things I noticed. Number one, Jerry and Buddy are introduced as the Canadian Tag Team Champions. Roberto Soto is introduced as not only your Georgia champion, but they mentioned that he and Dick Steinborn hold the Georgia Tag Team Champions. Dare I say, Barry, as I watched, I couldn't help noticing it was a very good crowd, very into the whole matches. Also, can't help but notice, Barry, here we are in Atlanta, Georgia in the early 70s. This was a very selective crowd. There was noticeably missing any of the African-Americans that may have lived in the area. I don't know if they weren't invited to the show or what, but there was literally no black people that were at this show, or at least that we saw on camera, so which I thought was just incredibly odd. So the guy mentions that Tommy Sigler is a fine athlete, a fine gentleman, and then he says, you know, I don't say that about every wrestler, so if I say it, by God, it must be true. And again, Ed Caprell and Ray McKay. Ed Caprell was the guy that was with the Georgia promotion before the split, and I guess he went with Gunkel. And I don't think that they could kiss Ann Gunkel's ass any more than they did in this match, because they not only mentioned how beautiful she was and that she's better looking than any promoter they've ever seen. The guy that really stood out to me during this match was, as you said, was Jody Hamilton. He was, and I love the Hollywood Blondes. I remember it was great to have a chance to finally go back and look at a match with the Hollywood Blondes, and they were good. But the guy that really you sit there and you find yourself going, wow, this guy is Jody Hamilton. He was absolutely friggin' amazing in this. Jerry Brown already looks old in this match. Oh, yeah. I know he went for at least another 10 years. Let's see. So what ends up happening is Tommy Sigler pins Jody Hamilton after kind of a schmoz with Jerry Brown and the Assassin. And the announcer says, and I quote, pandemonium and bedlam do not adequately describe what has happened here in the Oglethorpe gym, which I thought was a great line. So yeah, fun stuff, a great time capsule look at All South Wrestling in December of 1972. And just great fun going back and to be able, you know, and usually I got to say during the tape trading days, Barry, you'd get a match like this and it'd be about sixth or seventh generation and there'd be all kind of tracking lines and that kind of nonsense. And it didn't, but this is, wow, just so pristine, the quality. I believe you said, you know, where the copy of this match came from, didn't you?
Well, if I'm correct. Yeah. So there are two matches that are out there. And the other one is actually Dick Steinborn versus Tommy Sigler. It's a baby, and you can see this on YouTube as well. It's a baby face versus baby face matchup. These are the only two matches that I've ever seen from Gunkel's promotion, which was, I think it was the All South Wrestling Alliance, ASWA. But supposedly there is more that is out there. It's just not available, or it's not being put on YouTube. And, you just said something really important, but we're going to talk about something in a minute, and there's fucking squiggly lines and it's like 20th generation. Like,
exactly. You know? Yeah.
And that's from 10 years later. That's the crazy part. We're looking at this and this comes in as clear as anything. But yeah, this is, I'll be watching this again. This isn't something that,
Definitely recommend you take a look at this. It's a really fun match. We appreciate the Dirty Blondes suggesting it to us. And a shout out to those guys. Again, it was great meeting you at the Fan Fest. Barry, do you know what time it is, my friend?
Oh, you know what? Wow, we've been on for almost 2 hours. I do know what time it is. This is awesome. This is like an unexpected
Florida man totally or not. Are you ready, Mr. Rose?
I'm very excited about it.
The first headline: student bakes cookies with grandparents' ashes, hands them out at school. A high school student reportedly baked cookies that contained the ashes of his dead grandparents, then passed them out to his classmates. Police are investigating after several students claim to have eaten the cookies mixed with human remains. Barry, Florida or not?
I'm going to say no.
You are correct, sir. Davis, California.
Yes,
on
the board
for one. So, okay, Barry, next story, we're going to go Airport security finds roasted pig's head in checked bag.
That's awesome.
Some things you expect to find but are surprised when they don't. Case in point, an alert security canine was checking bags at the airport and found a cooked pig's head inside someone's. You cook the pig's head and you throw it in the suitcase. You know, certainly the dog will not cue on that one, Barry. So yeah, Florida or not Florida? That.
So I'm going to admit I am aware of this story, and I will say this occurred in Georgia. However, as a caveat, the man was from Florida.
Well, you know, what can I tell you, Barry? So partial credit, partial bonus for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's another one, Barry. Mayor wanted sex in exchange for speed bumps, ethic panel says. A mayor's in trouble with state ethics watchdogs who say he sought sex in exchange for installing speed bumps in a woman's neighborhood. David Stewart misused his position in an attempt to obtain sexual benefit for himself. The Commission of Ethics said in a statement on Wednesday, Barry, Florida or not Florida?
I'm going to say this one was Florida. With the other two not being Florida, I'm going to say this one. And then you're saying speed bumps, and my God, speed bumps are everywhere in Florida. So, yes, Florida.
Lantana, Florida, Barry. Correct, Amundo.
Wow.
So, let's see. Okay. Man was convicted for engaging. Barry, I'm going to try to top your small horse story there. You know, we always try to one up that or the licking of the stripper the pole. Yeah, giving you
syphilis or something. Chlamydia. Yeah. What was it? Yeah.
Here we go. A man was convicted of engaging in sexual activity with a miniature donkey. According to the Huffington Post, President Carlos Romero was arrested after a witness saw him with his pants down up against the rear of the donkey. When questioned by detectives, he admitted that when the donkey is in heat, he'll stand behind her, scratch her, and masturbate. According to television, he has done with this with the donkey 5 or 6 times.
Wow.
Barry, Florida or not?
I'm going to say not Florida.
Barry, you would be incorrect as we are talking Ocala.
Yeah. Oh, horse country. I should have known. Well, absolutely. It's horse country. Sure.
Okay. And our final story today, the headline, Barry, 346-pound man punches delivery man for forgetting the garlic knots. Man was allegedly punched his police to delivery man because he forgot to deliver garlic knots. According to the Huffington Post, Robert Wheeler, who was 48 at the time, was arrested after an altercation with then 19-year-old delivery man Jonathan Fagan. Fagan stated in a police report that Wheeler punched him below the left eye. Fagan wrote that Wheeler struck him because he forgot the garlic knots. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
I'll say not Florida.
Vero Beach!
God damn it, I was doing so good, and then the last two I tanked. And garlic knots, Jeff, we just talked about it on the comfort food. We were talking about garlic knots from Florida. Yeah, I should have seen all the signs. And then fucking horse country. I should have seen all the signs for those last two stories. What's the matter with me?
There were signs on the road ahead, and you chose to ignore them. Okay, now, folks, as we start to wrap up this show, as we're, what are we, 3 hours now, Barry? We're getting close to it.
Yeah, we're about there.
Yeah, so I happen to see a link on, I don't know if you'll Facebook or Twitter, and I sent it to Barry because it was so entertaining to watch, and it just shows you how great the Georgia promotion was. I want to say this was a time frame of about 1981-ish, maybe late in the year, and it involved Tommy Rich. And, of course, for those of you who don't know, Tommy Rich was super – I want to say for about a two- or three-year window, was just monster over in Atlanta. He then went back to Tennessee – and he did a turn where he became heel, the famous After magazine cover, "The Fans Can Go to Hell," says Tommy Rich. And he then turned the famous angle with his mom and Jimmy Valiant. So eventually now it's time for Tommy to come back to Atlanta, GA. And Barry, if you got a chance to look at the video, tell the folks about it. And it's just, for all the tracking lines, this is fucking gold, folks.
Yeah, and let's be clear, there are a lot of tracking lines throughout this thing. So it's definitely something. I don't know if this is one single video or did somebody do some sort of compilation? Because I can't see – I have a feeling it's a fan-produced compilation of Tommy's return. But I will tell you, I mean, and I took some notes off it. It's about 15 or 16 minutes, so it's, and it's easy watching. The beginning of it basically shows the fabulous Freebirds destroying Steve Kern and Steve-O, Steve Olsonowski. And I believe Gordy is outside the ring and he's getting ready to do a pile driver on the concrete on Steve-O. And out of nowhere, Wildfire gets fired up, comes out, makes his return to Georgia, clears house, and makes it happen. I will say right before that, Steve Kern delivers a forearm to Terry Gordy and knocks Gordy out of the ring. And Steve Kern was gold. I'm going to go to my grave saying Steve Kern, pre-Fabulous Ones, if you got to see him, there was zero flaw in the game. He was a Jody Hamilton in a sense. Everything he did was great, but it's not what we're here talking. So anyways, so Tommy Rich clears house, and does his fired up promo. And then they go into a music video and it's On the Road Again. And it's one of those early 80s cheese fests that you would only get from professional wrestling. And it's Willie Nelson on the road again, and it's Tommy getting in the car and then, you know, focusing on Tommy as he's driving the car and then focusing on Tommy as he gets out of the car. Like, you know, and I'm sitting there going, wow, it's like this kind of shit would never play today, you know, but in the early 80s, sure, it works. And then Tommy opens up his trunk and takes out his bag, and then the song ends. And then it's video highlights of him returning, and they show stuff from Memphis. There's stuff against Jimmy Valiant and Tojo Yamamoto and against the Bounty Hunters and the Novak Brothers. So that's a really, really good look. And then they figure, and whoever produced this, and this part came from Georgia. Well, there's a second music video, and it's Georgia, but it's not the Ray Charles version. It's the Willie Nelson version. We're sticking with Willie. And there is one of the most classic scenes of all time. It's Tommy, and I believe it's a Trans Am he's got, right? Because every cool baby face had a Trans Am in the early 80s. And Tommy gets on his CB radio, and it's Wildfire. And he's doing it. I'm sitting there going, this is gold. This is fucking unbelievable to see this. So it's about 15 minutes or so. It's a lot of fun. It moves super quick. You will not be bored. And the truth is, Tommy, you know, I think so. I went into this and my first thought was I knew who Tommy Rich was. And when I say that, Tommy Rich was a limited worker who bled a lot, who had shitloads of charisma, but was really able to connect with the audience. And I got to say, I mean, and while all that's pretty accurate, at the same time, he moved around really good. You know, there was, I think I'm also thinking of Tommy towards the mid 80s. Because really, within 3 or 4 years of this, he had started to gain weight. He had slowed down. He had that gut going. He was still in pretty decent shape here because Tommy never hit a gym. You know, there was never that period. But, you know, there was a way, and it was, I talked with Bugsy McGraw at great length at the Fan Fest, and we were talking about heels and baby faces. And Bugsy was very successful when he turned in Florida in 1979. He went from heel to babyface overnight and instantly became like the top heel in the state. Like he was right there with Dusty. Like it was like magic. And the truth was Tommy had that same kind of charisma where he could connect with an audience. You know, it wasn't just that he had, let's say, Dusty Rhodes, you know, personality of 10 people. It was that connection with the audience, and Tommy definitely had that. And it's apparent when you watch this video as well, because when he returns, the fans just lose their minds.
Yeah, no, and, you know, the one thing I like about it is, you know, one of the criticisms of the wrestling industry today with the WWE is the scripted interviews. And here, you know what they told Tommy Rich, okay, go out there and talk about how you're coming back to Georgia. Boom, that's it. And all that shit that he came up, you know, and he sits there, and I mean, they're showing the video, and it's Tommy by his house in Tennessee, and he's going by the pond, and he's throwing rocks at the pond and skipping rocks. And while this is happening, he's doing the voiceover. And the voiceover is just like, yeah, Tommy Rich, you know, I left the folks in Georgia, and Georgia's my home, and Wildfire wants to come back for all the fans who remember Wildfire. And it's, you're watching going, oh my God, I want to go to the matches and cheer for this guy. And then you see Tommy, and he's going to the matches apparently in Tennessee, and he's got the bag, and he goes in the rear entrance of the place. And then you see him, like you said, working with some of the teams there. And then he gets in the Trans Am. He's on the CB and he's heading back for Georgia. All the while, you got Willie Nelson, and it's fucking fantastic. And whoever posted it, I don't know who you were, but man, was it great to watch and just super, super fun. And we really appreciated it, Barry. And so, yeah, it's definitely a fun watch. And if I can find, I send you the link. But yeah, so we'll post a link to that. But it's something, like Barry said, it's a quick 15 minutes of just watching what made Tommy Rich the great babyface that he was for a good, oh, geez, he had about a 4 or 5 year run in Georgia. And he was super, super over, Barry.
He was too. And it's, you know, I remember when he first arrived in Georgia, and then I remember when he left and he went back to Memphis. And I don't know if he ever recaptured at the same level. To some degree he did, because he had the whole feud with Buzz Sawyer and was so over. But there was something, I think he was a different Tommy Rich. And if I'm correct, the fans in Georgia knew that he had been heel. I forget whether it was the magazines or whatever. So they were aware, and it's almost like he came back as the adult Tommy Rich versus the kid who had been there before.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It just, you know, and I just don't know if he was able to capture exactly what he had, but you know, Tommy Rich in Georgia for a certain period, was just gold. But hey, Jeff, I wanted to point something out too. And my memory, I'm hit or miss with what I remember at this stage, but, I wanted to thank everybody in our Facebook group. If you're listening and you're not a member, it is the Breaking Kayfabe with Boudrin and Barry Facebook group. We are well over 1,000 members at this point. It is a fun group. It is a group that is very accepting, because it's essentially almost anything goes. So I encourage you, if you're listening, to join. A lot takes place over there, but we got a great reception to last week's show with the wedding. And as you and I were recording it, I remember we hung up after we finished recording, and we're like, you know, we don't know if people are going to want to hear an hour and a half of wedding talk. You know, we were unsure, but the reception to it, people loved it, you know, and definitely the Hertz Car Company will never be the same. People were very upset, but it also dawned on me as I was going back and reflecting on the weekend that you left something out. And when you did one of your speeches that night, how you had referenced what I believe was, and I know that I brought it up, I forget in what context, maybe it was one of my favorite guy movies, but there was a line from a movie that's one of my favorite movies of all time, and you on purpose, intentionally, used that line, and you looked at me, and I remember recording this as well. We do have the footage of this. But Jeff, do you want to recite the line?
Yeah, what had happened was I had gone up to Georgia a couple days before the ceremony, and I can't believe we forgot to talk about this, Barry. And somehow, in the context of being in the car with my daughter and my wife, we started talking about The Warriors, the great movie from the late 70s, and the great speech by Cyrus to all the gangs, where he says, "What we've got over here is, you know, this gang and this gang and this gang. And, you know, think about all," it's one of the great speeches in film history, in my view. And what he says at the end is he gives a line that's been stolen by Shaquille O'Neal, and it's a great line to steal. But what he says at the end is, "Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it, suckers?" And so I was listening to that, and I started thinking about it, and I said, you know, that'd be a great way to end my introduction to all the people that have come to the wedding. And so Kelly like looks at me and goes, "Oh yeah, no, you have to do it. Absolutely." And so of course Kim, being the genteel mother of the bride, says, "Well, yeah, but don't include the suckers part, because that wouldn't be a nice way to welcome our guest." And so I talked to the pending bridegroom about it, and he was like, definitely on board. So, "Oh yeah, you got to cut a promo." So, I did not tell the esteemed Mr. Barry Rose. I said, "I'm going to do something in my speech, and when I begin doing it, you will know exactly where I'm going." And Barry was nice enough to film my speech welcoming everyone to my daughter's reception. And so, Barry, at what point did you know that I was cutting the Cyrus promo?
It was towards the end. It, you know, it took me a minute. But I think it was when you said, and we've got the Bowdrins over here, and you know, and the Poes over here. You were referencing the different families. At that point, it was all starting to gel, and then I was able to figure out where you were going with it. And I was very you had subliminally, that's not the right word, you had clued me in a little bit that something was going to take place. It was going to be an inside reference that I would get. So I was definitely, my ear was open, waiting for it. But yeah, that was a really fun moment. We had two, you know, this is what sucks too. It is the postpartum deal, because we had two really solid, fun weekends. And this weekend, I've already promised my wife I'll be cleaning the house with her. So fuck that, you know, exactly. Like, I don't want to do that.
All right. Yeah. I plan on planting my fat ass on the couch this weekend and just relaxing after traveling two straight weekends. So, folks, I will encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the great Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next week, we will no longer talk about that person who we talked about. And we'll talk to you next week, folks. I'll try to come up with even better stories. I don't know if that's possible, Barry. But until next week, have a good one, folks.